高的这个高的一条路的话，我们要去的
Artist Friends Podcast.
Hi, I'm Diane Hunt. I am an impressionist realist painter connecting with nature through my brush. I work in oil paint and watercolor, and I live in the countryside of Maryland's Eastern Shore, not far from the Chesapeake Bay. You can find me online at dianehuntstudio.com. and on Facebook and Instagram at Diane Hunt Studio.
Hi, I'm Constance Brosnan of Steve Brosnan's Jewelry Designs. I live in Oklahoma on a prairie, and I make handmade jewelry in silver, copper, and brass. I'm an artist that paints. I paint pastels and in oil sometimes.
Hello, this is Bly J. Kale. I'm the host of this podcast. I am a emerging representational artist. I do historic renderings, seascapes, landscapes, botanicals, birds, and whatnot. The tight illustrative hand in watercolor, pen and ink, and acrylic paints. And I live in Oklahoma City. And welcome to the Artist Friends Podcast. This is Clyde J. Kale, and you are listening to episode 71 for Monday, November the 16th. And I am here with my two best artist friends, Diane Hunt and Constance Brosnan. And hello, Diane.
Hi, Clyde. Hi, Constance. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Constance.
Hi, Clyde. Hi, Diane. Hello, everybody.
Welcome. Really, you two are keeping me sane. You keep me company here every Monday for my lonely world as a working artist. Okay. If our listeners will go to www.talkartpodcast.com. That's talkartpodcast.com. You will see our information page with our link. And this week I selected two videos, kind of talking a little bit about art history, and that's our theme is forgotten artists or lost artists. Yeah. And the first video was with the talking about the impressionists, the forgotten impressionists. And I'll let Diane lead off the discussion on the, did you know of those artists that were presented in there, Diane, or?
Yeah, I've heard of them all before. Well, they talked about Degas, however they want to say it, quite a bit. But and how his family was kind of aristocratic, and he was like basically a spoiled brat and didn't do things the way they were should have been done according to them, and how he kind of was stepping outside his or their comfort zone, I guess, trying different things and doing experimental kind of work, even though he had been trained like in the old style of creating work. He kind of branched out from that and took it into his own hands and did some things that they didn't really approve of too much. But and then they talked about a lot of the women artists, impressionist artists. So, and they, I guess that was the first time really that there was a group of women that were actually allowed to be shown, you know, to be in shows.
Absolutely.
Although they were in with the Impressionists, which probably they were kind of an outcast group of people, of artists from the traditional artists at the time. So that was their foot in the door, though, at least.
Women. Yeah, they were more recognized along with the Impressionist group instead of just being an afterthought years later, okay, we found these ladies who were impressionists, you know, but they were included in the shows that were being showed at that time, which was a new voice.
It's, you know, yeah, certainly was, because there was no women's liberation back in the 1800s in France. I mean, you were actually, as women, you were discouraged from being an artist. Oh, you don't want to do that. No, regardless of how talented you were. So, yeah, when I think about when I hear how they managed to establish a career and to establish themselves as artists, it was really quite remarkable. You know, mm-hmm. The barriers, you know, they had to deal with, you know, and everything. So it was interesting. Now, there's one, and I didn't write down my notes. I didn't write down his name, but there's one of the, in the last part of the video, I think his name starts with a G, a Krieg or Craig or something like that, who came from a very wealthy family. They were bankers, and he himself was a banker, and he decided, he was older, and I guess he was like in his 40s, you know, and he decided to become, you know, pursue a professional career as an artist. And he built a fancy studio in his top of his apartment building, his mansion where his family lived, you know. And what was interesting was the workman who was refurnishing varnishing his studio, the wooden floor, he actually did a painting of them. Yeah, and it was really rather outstanding and rather strange, because even all the impressionists, they were always doing, you know, the country life and a little bit of the aristocratics, and, you know, and he was just ordinary workman. He was painting, and he he found a delight in you know, one of the few artists of that time period who kind of painted, you know, common people. It was considered common people, you know, the street people, you know, and
workers. And
yeah, you're talking about Caliveau.
Maybe that was him. Yeah.
Yeah, and he did that, and he also Degas did like prostitutes and stuff. He didn't do like, you know, necessarily the aristocratic type people. And he did a lot of the, like ballerinas at the opera house. That opera house was unbelievably beautiful inside. that was crazy.
I loved that series of artwork that he did, the ballerinas. That just, I mean, when you get up close to him, you can really see the impressionistic style, even with pastels, the way he did them, because, you know, the faces, nothing's really detailed. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's just, it's very impressionistic, which is beautiful.
And, yeah, I know. I figured you would like the Degas pastel, you as a pastel artist.
Yeah, I appreciate his work. I mean, to get to see it.
Oh, and pastels is one and the same. I mean, that's all, you know. Yes, he did oil paint, but he was more known for his pastels, you know. Degas pastel was, you know, very cherished, you know, collectors, you know, mm-hmm. over the world, you know, in museums, you know.
Well, they talked about two of his different views, like how the views that he took when he depicted his, the ballerinas and even the other people. It was either from below looking up at them or above looking down, which was really different from what was being done at the time. So that was like a whole step out of the norm.
One of the other artists that was mentioned was Gauguin, but mm-hmm. it was a different perspective, because, you know, the history, you know, a lot of your collectors and your, we call you historians and critics, you know, they know Gauguin was a friend of Van Gogh, and Gauguin was wild and was a fighter and womanizer, and they emphasize all that. But in reality, before, he didn't pursue that life until like he was in his late 40s, you know, whatever. But before that, he was a very staunch family man, he very much liked being married and having a family. And they were, you know, a lot of his work, his early work, you know, was all centered around his family, you know, pains of his wife and his children, very, very loving and very passionate. And, you know, I didn't know that about Gauguin. So I thought that was really, for me, that was interesting. You know, that's why they said the lost artists are the lost, you know, because these are lost facts, you know, that kind of get lost in history. And, you know, we developed this image of these artists and their when, you know, a lot of them lived dual lives, you know, two and three different lifetimes, you know, were in their career. And Gauguin was one of those, because his later career was when he was, you know, into the, you know, after he went to Tahiti. And the thing about it is, it wasn't really, he went to Tahiti because his wife left him, because he tried a normal life. He tried normal jobs, and he had a very difficult time providing for his family, because he had a very large family. But they said he had, I mean, what, six or seven kids, something like that. Yeah. And,
something like that. I don't remember exactly.
And he had a hard time providing for his family. Every job that he took, non-art job that he took, he ended up failing. You know, he just wasn't successful. And you know, his wife left him because he took the kids and left because, you know, he couldn't provide, you know, for him. So
he just couldn't cope with it. It just was not his nature to be a work at a job, you know.
Yeah. No, he had that, it's like one Paul Klein, you know, made a comment. As an artist, you're an artist, you can't help it. It's something in you. You have to do it. Gauguin's a good example. He had to be an artist. He had, you know, he couldn't do anything else. And so, you know, he went to Tahiti to get away, because his, you know, to console himself. And he led that bohemian life as a result of losing his family, you know. So when you understand that, that's what I like, a lot of these documentaries, because if you don't pay attention to the critics, but really look at some of the historians and you look at the inner, then you start understanding. And show in a video, you know, they show their art, you start understanding, you know, why, you know, the other side, the artists, they become far more real. And for me, they kind of resonate, you know, that we can understand why, because they didn't, out of the gate, they weren't famous. Yeah.
They had lives and they had families and, you know, ups and downs and stuff, just like everybody else.
So. Struggling.
And a lot of times it did affect their art.
Absolutely. Speaking of that, then the second video, and I thoroughly enjoyed the second one when I found it, was the Barbarians, the Art of the Barbarians. Because when, you know, history tells us, you know, the barbarians, you know, so maligned because, you know, they, the fall of the Roman Empire was due to the barbarians. And I like when he's in this museum and it shows a painting, standing from a painting, and it shows this naked man, you know, climbing up on the shoulders of another man to rip down the statue of Caesar, you know. And he said, this is a depiction of the barbarians sacking Rome. But in reality, they didn't go around naked. And I like what he said, because he said, actually, because of the barbarians, we wear trousers today.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for them, they'd all be wearing the
togas.
Togas,
yeah.
Can you imagine riding a horse? I cringed when he said that.
It cannot be easy riding a horse in togas. It cannot be easy. The wind starts blowing your skirts up.
I don't think it'll be happening.
They rode horses. That's how they attacked Rome. They were excellent horsemen, you know. Is that they so they could ride horses? Yeah.
Well, I thought it was interesting how the barbarian, you know, people say barbarians, and you think of, you know, these wild people that are like, you know, living off the land or something. They're just like totally wild and uneducated and all that stuff. But that's not really what they were. And it was more of a name for their clan or their tribe or whatever. And the name, the word now has bad connotations to it. And it's just like, what was the other one? There's the barbarians and the...
The Visigoths. Yeah. The Visigoths.
The Goths. The Goths. And there was the other one.
Attila the Hun was in that. And what is the other one? I write it down here. Let's see.
It was a word like that that's got a bad connotation today, but it was really the name of their tribe or whatever.
Yeah.
There were still several different branches of Goths also. Mm-hmm. What is it?
And that's not anything like the Goths around today either. That was kind of funny.
Yeah, that is.
The kids that are Goths today probably wouldn't even recognize what the Goths were like back then.
Is it
the agrarians or Aryans?
Aryans, yeah. Yeah.
There were Aryans, but they were...
That wasn't the one.
Their portrait of Jesus, because they built all these bathhouses and put all the mosaics up, the religious mosaics up in the bathhouses, and they did their own version of what they thought Jesus should look like rather than what he may have really looked like, which we don't really know for sure nowadays. I mean,
well, I was surprised that the barbarians were actually Christians.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think of them of having a religion, or you wouldn't think of them. You'd think of, from that word, you think they were like honoring, multiple gods or like weird things.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think that they were Christians.
They went around pillaging all the time, gaining in territories and,
The Roman Empire, was the power, the superpower of the time. And of course, they were, it wasn't several hundred years later before the Roman Empire became Christianized, but at that time they were, the pagans. And yes, the Christians were, they lumped them all together with the barbarians, and everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What was interesting was the art of the barbarians that, history portrays them as, these wild people and vicious, and they attack the Roman Empire and they kill people and everything. But when you look at their art, you get a company.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. All that tile work.
Yeah, the mosaics.
And then the dishes that they had, the gold.
Oh, yeah.
They made their own, plates and their accoutrements or whatever they call it. The cook pots were one out of iron, but all of their dinnerware was gold,
What I found very interesting was it was the Visigoths. They were the ones who made, a lot of their gold. And they said there's this tons and pounds of gold.
They even made jewelry for their horses.
The horse and everything. And
garnets and stuff, mounted into the metal.
When you research, you would think, well, they were miners, they had good mine operations. No.
They pillaged.
Pillaged, but more importantly, that gold was extortion from the Romans, because the Romans tried to pay them off to stay away.
And they just melted it down and the coins down and made something else out of it.
They found documentary, evidence of where the records of where the Romans were paying pounds, tons and tons of gold coinage, to keep them away.
I didn't think about it, but where was gold even coming from at that time? I know you have to mine for it. We know where it comes from here in America, Alaska and California during the gold rush, but
I think a lot of it's coming from Africa.
The gold?
Yeah.
So there's gold in Africa also? Well, I mean, I don't have a lot of knowledge about, except for what America, the gold sources in America. But that's way a long time ago, and that was a lot of gold.
Oh, yeah.
I just wondered if they had mines for it or where it came from.
The Roman Empire, stretched all across, the Mediterranean and into northern Africa. And during that time period, it's all been depleted now over the century.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, it was very wealthy. That's the only reason. It's interesting. Unlike modern day superpower, modern day empires, you know, where, you know, they either, you know, conquest a country to help rebuild a country or to, you know, help the population. No, in the Roman period, if they attacked a country, took over a country, it was so they could pillage its resources, period. You know? They were all over, you know, like I said, the Mediterranean, all over in Africa, and all the northern part of Africa, because it was rich in minerals and, you know, and jewelry and precious stones and gold and silver. And, you know, that's the only reason why they took over those countries. Otherwise, they would have probably left them alone, because as far as, and of course, then they made, you know, slavery out of the people, you know, and everything. And, you know, in one sense, the Roman Empire, like I said, they are the basis for, you know, Western civilization. They're, but their literature, because they blended in, you know, the Greeks and everything. So, yeah, in that sense, you know, they contributed to our development of the, you know, Western civilization. But on the other hand, they were extremely vicious.
That's how they conquered all that. They were spread out over the whole continent, pretty much.
Yeah,
at one point.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can
had a very large territory by the toward the end of their reign.
You can find Roman ruins, you know, all over. I mean, yeah, Roman ruins in England, Roman ruins all over in Spain and in France, and over in Yugoslavia, and all the way down to, you know, in Africa, down in the, you know, around the Egypt, you know, and there. So they were pretty much everywhere, and they did develop. They were very good. They built good roads, you know, so that hey, you got to have a way to get that gold back, you know, back. So, you know, that's why they built roads. And then they built good, you know, encampment, military establishments, you know, to protect it and everything. And I feel very fortunate and blessed, because when I was in the Navy and stationed and living in Italy, let me tell you, every opportunity I took to go visit, you know, some ruins. And because they were everywhere, I mean, I lived in an apartment complex, and the field behind was a soccer field for the kids to play in, but surrounding it was Roman ruins. Yeah, and I would go and be looking at those and climbing over and exploring, and a lot of it was covered with graffiti, which was really saddened me. But it was interesting, you know. And there was caves, different places I would explore, you know, in a cave, go down in a cave.
Yeah, I think us as like U.S. citizens, we're not used to having a history that long, you know, that far back. I mean, but in Europe and those countries over there, they have history that goes back so far. It's just crazy. It's hard for us to relate to it a little bit, I think.
Our oldest history in this country is from the Native Americans, where they, you know, drew on the side of cliffs in caves.
Absolutely. You know, so, but compared to, you know, the rest of the world, yes, it's very, very, it's very small percentage. We're still a very young country, you know, and, you know, for us, it's something 50 years old, 100 years old, you know, we call it old. 1,000 years old over there before, you know, it's old. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we got a little off topic there, but I didn't realize that the barbarians were so artistic. I followed, because, you know, what I studied in school, you know, they were barbarians. They led to the fall of the Roman Empire, and they destroyed things and they killed people. But when you look at their art, history has.
They were very cultured, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very, very cultured. And so I hope you two enjoyed those videos. At least I enjoyed them. And I hope our listeners will take the opportunity to visit www. talkartpodcast.com. That's talkartpodcast.com. And the links are there. And take some time. They're, each video is about an hour long. And take some time. And, hey, that's why I love YouTube. There's so much. I can go down a rabbit hole. Not getting there's so many.
That's an easy thing to do.
One video after another. And I love history. So for me, it just feeds my, I'm in heaven. I can watch a, historical video drop of a hat. The last video I thought was really interesting because this artist, she doesn't make videos that often, but when she does, really got her interest. It was just a little 10-minute one when she said, I thought it was kind of, funny. Things not to say to an artist. Have you ever had any of those things said to you that she mentions?
I'm going to have to, I forgot to watch that one. So you guys are going to have to cover that. But yeah, I know about things that people shouldn't say to artists. They don't realize they're not saying a nice thing when they're saying it, but yeah.
What about you, Diane? Have you ever had that experience?
Yeah, I've had numerous people ask for donations for charities. And what I try to do is have them, I have donated things to charities in the past myself, but what I tried, if I believe in the charity, but if somebody approaches me and it's not a charity that I would normally contribute to, I try to get them to find a patron that will buy my work. And then let the patron donate it for to the charity, because we as artists can't take any deductions for that. We can't take other than our, the material cost, which is not much compared to the, the price of the work would be. So that way everybody wins if you do it that way.
That's an idea. Yeah. I never thought about that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good way to approach it. I mean, I've given, especially with the jewelry, I've given, somebody comes and I'll let them have something, but.
Yeah, but see, if somebody buys it, then they can write it off if they donate it to the charity and the charity gets it. So they can auction it or whatever, sell it or whatever they're doing with, wanted to do with the work to begin with. And the artist gets money too. So everybody wins, really. It's like.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a good way to handle it. Yeah. I've only received one or two emails, asking me if I wanted to participate in like a charity auction or something, but I've never had anybody approach me. The one thing she mentioned, which has always been in the back of my mind, when she says, somebody ask her to create a piece of artwork, but then they only want to buy the print. When doing commissions, whenever I complete the work, I always send it in a low resolution postage stamp size art proof to the client, because I've never had this happen, but it's always been in the back of my mind that, they could say, okay, yeah, I don't like it. But then they'd go ahead and they take that and blow it up and sell it. Yeah.
And print it for themselves. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've had people approach me for commissions and they want a certain thing done in a certain style. And it's not even like how I paint. It's like something they saw somewhere and they want me to do a copy of it, basically. And I just won't do that kind of thing. But,
there's copyright issues to begin with,
Yeah, I don't think people understand the whole copyright thing at all.
They just think it's a free...
Yeah,
and the other thing is too, they think you're an artist, so you can create anything you want to create, and it's something that's not even your style, or it's not even like anything near what you do. it's like it's not even related. It's like,
when I receive inquiries about doing commissions, the first thing I do in my reply was I give them my pricing, but I also tell them, look at my website to see my style of art. Mm-hmm. Make sure that it is, what you might like before I even accept a commission.
Yeah.
I don't accept a commission on the first email. I send exchange two or three emails, because I want the client to understand that, hey, I don't do photorealistic work. So if you're expecting that, you're not going to get that.
You're not going to be happy. Yeah.
So I don't even attempt, and I've never had any difficulty this long because they, you know, either they're in the initial inquiry, they say they've seen my artwork on the, you know, on the site, and they would like for me to do a, you know, a portrait of their pet, you know, or whatever. And, you know, up front. So they know already up front my style and my quality and, you know, what. So there's no extra expectation, you know, whatever. And I've been very successful in not having any kind of a rejection. You know. But I still only send the postage stamp, the low resolution, because there's always that in back of my mind. Because I've heard of it happening to other artists. And like this elephant. Mm-hmm. That, you know, they're always, you know, they, you know, want, you know, they want something for nothing, you know. Okay, if you really want my artwork, then pay for it. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've had people want like a 5-foot square painting or something, and they only want to pay you $25 for it. You know, it's like, that doesn't even cover the materials.
More than that,
you know?
For the materials.
Yeah.
They don't... You can't even buy the stretcher bars for something that big without it coming over $100.
Yeah, that's,
these are people,
you just have to educate people, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and it's, you know be polite. And it's like, you know, her recommendation is, instead of saying no, I don't do that kind of work, she just says, well, no, I'm pretty busy right now, you know. And that's a good way to reflect.
The problem with that though is that they might come back later and say, are you still busy? You know.
Yeah.
6 months.
Yeah.
You're like, I'm not gonna do it.
And I used to do,
I think it's better to just tell
jewelry
them
side,
front,
but yeah, I don't do commissions on the jewelry side anymore. I'm just, you know, just,
yeah,
almost stopped making jewelry.
I guess I've been blessed. I have never had the confrontation of, well, you know, you say you're, you know, you need work, but maybe if you lower your prices, you. I've never had any kind of discussion whatsoever. You know, I've quoted the price and they either accept it or they don't accept it. They don't come back with,
I'm trying to haggle.
I guess I've been blessed. I've been fortunate. People respect. They respect my artwork and they, yeah, they respect me as an artist. And I can't ask for more than that. You know, I'm not going to, you know, go down to make something out of nothing, you know? Okay, yep. We're about ready to wrap things up for this episode of the Artist Friends Podcast, episode 71. And I'm here with Diane Hunt and Constance Bronson. And Diane, you got a major event coming up. Tell us all about it.
Yes, my show that I'm in for the Oil Painters of America Eastern Division is coming up on Friday, the 20th. The opening's the 20th. And it runs until December 19th. It's at the Renhart Fine Art Gallery in Charleston, South Carolina. So if you're in the area and you'd like to see the show, stop in or call them and schedule an appointment. I think they're doing appointments because it's restricted with COVID and all that.
Yeah. Now, for the people that couldn't attend, where's the website? What's the website address where they could see it?
It's www.oilpaintersofamerica.com, and look for the Eastern, the OPA show. It's the Eastern Division, and there's links there to see the paintings that are being shown.
And they can find your name listed there, you know, Diane.
Yeah, yeah, they'll have the painting, the picture of the painting, and everybody's names next to them. It's all in alphabetical order.
Last week, it looked really good. It looks really, really good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is a jury show, too, right? So,
possibly
you could win, you know, win something. Yeah, and so.
Kathy Odom is the judge. She's a pretty well-known painter. And so we'll see. Keep your fingers crossed for me for Friday.
So, cool. Do you want to see some of Diane's artwork, then yes, go visit that website at oilpaintersofamerica.com and look at the original show and send an email to Diane, you know, to your comments, you know, she would enjoy hearing your comments. Okay, that is going to be it for this episode of the Artist Friends Podcast, episode 71 for Monday, November the 16th. My name is Clyde J. Kell, and I've been talking with Diane Hunt and Constance Bronson. I'm going to say goodbye now to both Diane and Constance. I'll let Diane say bye to everybody.
Bye, Clyde. Bye, Constance. Bye, everyone.
Good night, Clyde. Good night, Diane. Good night, everybody. Thanks for stopping in.
Thank you, folks. And as always, however you hear this podcast, please give us a star rating and a thumbs up. Thank you so much, folks. Bye-bye.
The Artist Friends Podcast is produced and edited by Clyde J. Kell. Participating artists, Diane Hunt and Constance Bronson, and Clyde J. Kell. You can find more information about Diane Hunt at www.dianehuntstudio.com. Constance Bronson at www.etsy.com/shop/CBROSNANS. Clyde J. Kell at www.cjkellartworks.com. If you would like to participate or appear as a guest on the Artist Friends Podcast, please email cjkell@mystery-otr.com. If you enjoy these podcasts, please give us a thumbs up or a star rating. And most of all, send us your comments. This podcast is issued under the Creative Commons license.